From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and after a nearly two-year investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, we finally heard today from Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who defended the investigation and finally addressed why his report did not make a ruling on whether President Trump obstructed justice.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing joins us now from Washington with more on this. Phil, some are reading this statement, and that's what it was. It was just a statement. Mueller did not take any questions. But some are reading it as Mueller basically telling Congress that the ball is in their court to say the president committed a crime. He couldn't rule on that issue.
Yeah, Mueller basically said today, this work is done. My role in this story is over. What I have to say, I've said in this report, and I'm going to go away from public life. And in fact, as you mentioned earlier, he's stepping down from the Justice Department altogether. Now this is up to others to deal with, both to litigate how much members of Congress see of the work product generated by the special counsel's office, and then what action, if any, members of Congress should take about the things that he discovered.
He also said he was basically comfortable with the amount of information that Attorney General William Barr made public when he released that redacted version of the Mueller report. What did you make of that?
Well, there had been all this questioning about whether there might have been some dispute between these two men who are old friends by Barr's account, who whose wives know each other, whose children played together or who attended each other's spouses, according to Barr's account, about whether they might have disagreed about the handling by the Justice Department leadership of these findings by Mueller. And Mueller actually wrote a letter to the Attorney General early on in this process saying, please make more of this information public, including these summaries that we've prepared for that purpose. Barr went on to release most of the full report, although portions of it remain redacted, and that's the subject of these disputes between Congress and the Justice Department. But what the special counsel appeared to say today was that he was good with how it all turned out in the end.
He also said that he does not believe it's appropriate for him to speak further about the investigation. What does that mean for his potential testimony before Congress?
Well, what he appeared to be saying to me was, if you get me to go up there, what I will say are things that you've already heard or read in the case of this report. What Mueller does not want to do, apparently, is litigate the decisions he took inside his own office with attorneys or about the merits of these Justice Department policies that say that he can't bring an indictment against the president while the president is in office. And that is probably to save himself from being the subject of a big political show, Democrats trying to get him to criticize Trump and talk more about wrongdoing that he might have discovered or alleged wrongdoing, and Republicans trying to do their best to either undercut the merits of his investigation or talk about what they've called the bias of Mueller's employees or to try to get Mueller to stand up for the president. Robert Mueller doesn't want to play that game. He doesn't want to be at the center of a big congressional set piece like that. And so he is going to say what he said and then go away, he hopes.
So if the ball is in Congress's court, we heard from the Democratic chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, today, who says it falls to Congress to respond to the crimes, lies, and other wrongdoing of President Trump. What is likely to happen now when it comes to the Democrats in Congress?
Well, what's likely to happen is the dispute among Democrats themselves will be intensified. Jerry Nadler, Elijah Cummings, Adam Schiff, these important House chairmen are getting impatient with the Trump administration not cooperating with investigations with this, what they call wrongdoing uncovered by Mueller. But the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, she's got her eye on the 2020 election next year about appealing to a national audience. And so there's no clear path forward for Democrats in terms of what to do or how exactly they'll respond.
It's NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thanks.
Thank you.
We'll revisit the Mueller statement over the program, but right now, this note from Dallas. The city has decided to sell that statue of General Robert E. Lee, which was taken down 2 years ago and has been sitting in storage. The city council designated the statue surplus property and will sell it to the highest bidder. City leaders saying a new buyer will have to pay at least $450,000 for the bronze sculpture because that's the cost of removing and storing it. So the auction of a Confederate monument is one option. The city of Franklin, Tennessee, went in another direction, voting to put African-American history markers around its Confederate statue rather than tear it down. Shalina Chetlani of member station WPLN tells us how that's going over.
Inside the town square roundabout in Franklin, Tennessee, a Confederate soldier nicknamed Chip is perched on top of a 37-foot monument. The statue was erected in 1899 to honor Confederate troops who lost their lives in the Civil War. Franklin Community Church pastor Kevin Riggs says he's irked by the writing on the monument's side, which suggests those soldiers fought for a noble cause.
The Civil War was about slavery. If that's the noble cause that they were talking about, then yeah, there's a little bit of uncomfortableness in reading that.
The Battle of Franklin was a significant moment in the Civil War. It was bloody, and it was the site of a significant Confederate defeat. So the statue, the plantations, and antebellum churches here are all popular tourist sites. But, Riggs says, the sites fail to represent the history of the nearly 12,000 slaves that lived around here before the war. The fact that close to Chip, slaves were sold in a market house. Nearby is a courthouse where there were public lynchings. Later, it was where slaves could get papers to become freed soldiers and fight for the Union. And after the war, start businesses downtown.
That is nowhere here. People don't know that story, and they need to. All they see is this.
It's kind of weird to be, you know, black in the city of Franklin.
Christian Nevels is a direct descendant of a former slave family at the nearby Carter House and Farm.
You feel like you're overshadowed by the Confederacy. I mean, granted, it's 2019, and so everybody's supposed to feel different, but you get the tours of all of the white history in Franklin, but what about the black history?
This sentiment is something Kevin Riggs hears often in his church, and it's part of why he helped create the Fuller Story Project. It aims to put African-American history markers around Chip, and across from him, there'd be a statue of a freed African-American soldier who fought with the United Colored Troops.
You see it around the country where people are tearing them down, and that's not what we wanted. Our goal was how can we unify.
Franklin is just one of many places across the country grappling with Confederate monuments and the social tension around them. Eric Stuckey is Franklin's administrator. He says the city voted in February to support the Fuller Story proposal because it seemed like a strategy that wouldn't cause controversy. And it was practical because Tennessee law punishes cities for removing historical monuments.
This was an initiative that was brought forward through the community that wanted to see a more complete story told. If it's public property, then we have the responsibility to use the public property in the way that meets community goals and vision.
But the approach hasn't met everyone's goals. The United Daughters of the Confederacy's Tennessee division has threatened to sue the city because it says it owns the land where Chip stands. Doug Jones is the group's lawyer.
Is there room in history to tell more? Absolutely, and the Fuller story needs to be told, but not on that little piece of ground.
Jones says Chip has been there for more than a century. His group believes the property should exist for a specific purpose.
We're not against the markers, okay? Slavery was terrible. Historically, traditionally, that little piece of ground right there is about honoring the people that fought at the Battle of Franklin.
A number of strategies have been proposed to address monuments, simply leaving them alone, removing them, putting them in museums. But Vanderbilt University historian Richard Blackett says while the community-based approach of the Fuller Story Project is promising, he's still skeptical.
The problem with the context, of course, is what there's going to be a debate about what constitutes the context.
Other cities like St. Augustine, Florida, and Raleigh, North Carolina, have tried the strategy. But ultimately, Blackett says these efforts are band-aids, not solutions. Just adding a few markers won't demonstrate the horrors of slavery or help the nation heal from the past, he says.
To a large extent, it leaves the issue unchallenged because the Confederate soldier is going to be there.
But the city of Franklin is proceeding. Some markers and the statue of a freed soldier will be placed in the town square. And city officials filed their own lawsuit to figure out who actually owns the land under Chip, so it can place other markers beside him. And for some residents, like Christian Nevels, winning the fight over Confederate monuments isn't really the point.
I think it's just letting people know that we are more than what we've been through.
For Here and Now, I'm Shalina Chatlani in Nashville.
If Paris is the city of lights, then New York City is the city of sounds. Below ground, a saxophone fills the subway platform silence, then a train pulls in. Doors open to reveal some percussionists. For a beautiful minute, they join forces. Then the train pulls away. City sounds can be music to your ears. They can also cause hearing loss. And worse, studies show children on lower floors closer to noise have reading problems. In adults, it causes disorders from chronic fatigue to heart disease, which is why a team of scientists at NYU is taking aim at New Yorkers' biggest civic complaint, noise, with a first-of-its-kind initiative to understand and address noise pollution, using a citywide acoustic sensor network to record bits of sound. And get ready, an army of citizen scientists to identify sound. We joined research scientist Mark Cartwright and postdoctoral researcher Graham Dove from NYU's Center for Urban Science Progress at one of the team's noise sensors on a busy street in Brooklyn. Above us, their handiwork.
That's us up there.
Oh, there you are.
We're up here.
The tiny little thing?
At the top, yeah. You come around to this side, you can see where the microphone cover is, where the windshield for the sensor and the little Wi-Fi antenna.
Well, that's way up in the air.
Yeah, that's about 20 feet up in the air, which is typically where we are. I mean, that gives us close enough to monitor what's going on in the terms of noise without being intrusive to people. And it's part of our process of making sure that privacy and security and consideration for residents is primary in the work that we do.
We hear sirens in the background. There's a bus coming down the street, so that it will pick up.
Yes, it's sensitive enough to pick up traffic as it's coming down, particularly the buses.
From there, we walk a few blocks to the NYU lab where the sensors are built and the data is analyzed. So we have entered the sanctum, I feel. We're in a, what would you say, 15-foot by 15-foot lab, glass-enclosed lab. Graham, what happens here?
The lab largely is used for building sensors. As you can see, we have a number of microphones. We have Raspberry Pi, which form the basis of our sensor.
Wait, Raspberry Pi, did you
say? Yes, so we use a Raspberry Pi, single core computing board.
Well, it could have been a Pi because I look over here and I see a toy fire truck.
It's a deeply important piece of research material. This is, where's the button? We have a button.
There we go.
When we're demoing the abilities of the sensor, particularly the machine learning aspects of the sensor, our little fire truck comes in very useful.
It would have to be just for a test because that's the quietest fire truck I've ever heard. And that's the point, is that you're trying to gauge the real sounds of the city. What is the goal of this whole sensor program?
The goal is to monitor, analyze, and mitigate urban noise pollution through this smart acoustic sensor network, which will provide more actionable information to city agencies and to citizens so that they can know the effects of different, say, interventions that they take to try to reduce the noise. And so we just have a better understanding of the noise in the city as well.
What are the dangers of the noise in New York?
Some people have said that things noise is kind of a silent killer, which is a weird way of saying it, because it's a long-term damage of being exposed to loud noises kills the upper register in your hearing. Over time and time, it becomes harder to not only hear in terms of volume, but make out in terms of clarity, particularly what people are saying in conversation.
I understand it's not just that. Noise can lead to hypertension, you're both nodding, lead to heart problems. The daily impact of noise can be a health issue.
That's true. It's kind of the cumulative effect of build up over time. So it's not necessarily the fact that you can choose to go into Times Square and be immersed in the busiest place in the world. It's that at some point in time, you can't get away from it.
Sensors are also to find out what the noise is. And this is where you bring in these citizen scientists who work with you to try to identify the noise?
So we use citizen scientists currently primarily to label the sound. So when we make recordings, very short, less than 10-second recordings of urban sound, which are then placed on a platform called Zooniverse. And on Zooniverse, the citizen scientists are given a selection of tags or labels which identify particular sounds or particular noises within that clip of sound. Now, these tags are closely linked to the NYC noise code. So therefore, we are looking for particular type of construction sounds or engine sounds, which are actionable by the New York Department of Environmental Protection as noise pollution.
So we've recorded about 130 million 10-second recordings.
Whoa.
And of those, we've had only 10,000 of them annotated thus far. We're hoping to get around 50 to 60,000 of these annotated.
And where human ears are limited, artificial intelligence steps in to help with that annotation. As sounds are identified, the computer applies that information to other sounds. It becomes more accurate and smarter. Still, the project is actively looking for, say, construction workers who might teach the computers the difference between a backhoe and a pile driver, for instance. And it needs the rest of us to identify the everyday sounds.
Engine sounds and alert signals like sirens and honking and car alarms. Human sounds in terms of like shouting and loud music from a car.
Of course, this all raises the issue of privacy and just what's recorded on sensors around a city.
So yeah, I think it's important at this point to say that the recordings we make are all limited to 10 seconds that are non-contiguous. We're not looking to build a rich picture of a particular location.
You're not spying.
We're not. That's entirely the word that we're trying not to say. Yes, but we are definitely not spying. There was a really big effort with independent consultants to prove that there was no way that any of our sensors can pick up conversation, can be used to monitor people, can be used to recognize people. We're interested in noise at a more abstract level.
So if a couple pulls themselves aside to have a private conversation and glance up and realize they're under one of your sensors.
One of our researchers stood a couple of feet underneath a sensor and literally shouted at the top of his voice the whole of the NYC noise code. And that was then listened back to by these external consultants who verified that, you know, it could not be pieced back into recognizable speech.
We head down the hallway to a smaller office where we're able to hear some of these clips. Okay, wait a second. Can I play Citizen Scientist?
Sure.
Okay, so what? Can you play that again?
Yeah.
Well, I think I heard a jackhammer in the background.
I don't think that was quite a jackhammer, actually. Okay. It was some sort of powered impact tool, but not a jackhammer. So for that, you know, you can label it as other unknown impact machinery.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list of choices. The jackhammer was there, but you went with an unknown.
Yeah, it would be nice if we were able to have labels for all the sounds you could possibly hear in the city, but we have to kind of keep it manageable to not be, you know, browsing through, you know, large menus. People really wouldn't label the birds in our recordings, but birds aren't really an actionable sound event for the DEP.
Right.
even when we don't have labels, you can actually kind of discuss it with other citizen scientists.
People must love this. I mean, I can imagine New Yorkers gathering, you know, around this, you know, this hearth and talking about the sounds of New York.
Often we'll kind of be discussing things with them as well. Like when they say, like, I think I hear this particular sound, we'll kind of go in and give them some feedback if we hear it as differently, you know.
Let's listen to another one. Okay, so in the choices, you've got jackhammer, hoe, ram, pile driver, non-machinery impact sound, chainsaw, rotating saw, large rotating saw, other unknown powered saw.
That sound that we just heard, I actually think was probably a street cleaner.
No.
I think it was.
Back out on the street at the sensor, nearly yelling to be heard, Mark and Graham reflect on how their noise research has impacted their lives.
I'm pretty lucky in the area that I live in isn't that noisy, but when there are offensive sounds, like I definitely take note and I have
we're gonna get you.
No, I've reported things to 311 now where I never did that before.
It's changed the way I look at the city in terms of I now look for opportunities. So I'll come across a situation, particularly where there's a big construction site on a crossway where there's lots of beeping, and I think, that would be a great place for us to have a sensor. So, yeah, I'm kind of always working around looking for places that we do, rather than worrying about how it's, which is probably bad, worrying about how it's actually affecting me, because I'm now going out looking for the situations that we're constantly saying are not necessarily very good for you.
But it's fascinating. I mean, you make us listen closer. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
NYU noise researchers Mark Cartwright and Graham Dove, they've started sharing their data with the New York Department of Environmental Protection, and it's helping that agency get a better sense of sound in the city so that eventually they can implement policies to reduce it. So, ready to be a citizen scientist? To find out more about SONYC, go to hereandnow.org.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more. All built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler said in a statement today that Robert Mueller's special counsel clearly demonstrated President Trump is lying about the counsel's findings, about witness testimony, lying in saying the special counsel found no obstruction. And Nadler said, now that Mueller, in his first public remarks since his investigation began 2 years ago, is resigning, Congress will do what Mueller said he couldn't. Today, Mueller, in his short on-camera statement, said his team left open the question of obstruction of justice, not because of a lack of evidence, but because of Department of Justice policy against indicting a sitting president.
It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge. So that was Justice Department policy. Those were the principles under which we operated. And from them, we concluded that we would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed a crime.
Joining us by phone, Representative Ro Khanna, the Democrat of California. And Representative Khanna, do you think Mueller today was talking directly to you, to Congress? He said, if we had had confidence the president clearly did not commit a crime of obstruction, we would have said so.
I do. I think he was talking to Congress and he was talking to the American people. and he has displayed incredible restraint and integrity throughout the process and displayed a reverence for our laws and our Constitution. The critical aspect now is for Congress to act. We need to continue to aggressively investigate the president. We need to do our work in all of the committees. I believe we need to decisively act, at the very least, to censure the president for a lot of the illegal acts. As you know, there's only one president, Andrew Jackson, has been censored before. So that would be a clear statement that these acts are unacceptable and violating our democracy.
Well, as you well know, there's a split in your party about whether to go forward with these kinds of investigations, whether to begin impeachment inquiries. What do you think happens now after Mueller speaking?
I think Mueller just reaffirms the need for Congress to do our job. My caucus is unified around the principle that there has to continue to be aggressive investigation, that the president has to be held accountable. I think many people will look to the committee chairs to do their work. My sense is a censure, at the very least, needs to take place, or some action by Congress that makes it clear that what the president did was illegal and wrong.
Well, as the president responded, though, he replied on Twitter. He said, nothing changes from the Mueller report. There was insufficient evidence, and therefore in our country, a person is innocent. The case is closed. Thank you.
Well, no one is talking about the criminal prosecution of the president. What we're talking about is holding the president accountable, and that is Congress's job. So Congress, the case is just beginning. We've received a report that Mueller has highlighted serious concerns. He has said that the conduct raised very grave concerns, and it would be a dereliction of our duty not to make it clear that this type of conduct should never happen again by a future president. Also, it's very important, I think, for
very briefly.
Folks understand that the interference in Russia was a major threat, and Bob Mueller concluded his press conference that Congress needs to act.
Ro Khanna, the Democrat of California, thank you.
Thank you.
Florida's new law that will make teachers eligible to carry guns in schools starting in the fall has generated a lot of discussion. Yesterday, we spoke with Bill Husfeldt, a superintendent in the Florida Panhandle who's in favor of the law. Today, we're joined by Gregory Pittman, a history teacher at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. He's opposed. Gregory Pittman, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Well, and I want to hear about why you oppose arming teachers. But first, just to let people know a little bit about your history with this, tell us a little bit about what your experience was when there was a shooting at your high school, such a famous shooting now in American history.
Yes, the 14th of February in 2018, I was in a class, my fourth period history class that day. And it was about 2:21, and the fire alarm goes off the second time that it had gone off that day. And normally at that time of day, it's not a would not be just a regular drill. And so we were waiting for someone to come on over the PA to say either the culinary department had burned something or the electrical system was being worked on, and they inadvertently set off the fire alarm, and no one came on. And so I'm looking at the kids, and it's like, all right, grab your phones, guys. We got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. And I'm about 400 feet from the 1200 building. I actually taught in that building the first 9 years it was open and moved to this room about a year before. So fortunately, I was here, not there with my students. And so we proceed to go out. And as we're going down and going out, another teacher ran up and told me that there was an actual shooting going on. And then the next thing you know, a student showed me a photo of another student on the floor in a classroom, all bloodied. And so we were quite aware all of a sudden that this was real and this was occurring. And so I guess the teacher mode certainly kicked in then, and we realized we needed to move these kids off campus. And so everything kicked in from there. And the biggest thing that I remember that day, one, was yelling at the kids because we kind of had a gate, unfortunately, would not open, and we needed to go file around one by one between a canal on one side, a fence on the other, to move the kids out. And a lot of them were trying to climb this fence, which some were getting stuck in the fence. And I remember yelling at the top of my lungs not to climb the fence because I was also worried about them getting cut in the fence. And you could see the panic in their faces. And so we obviously, as teachers, were concerned, we're just getting them safely off campus and moving them. And then just the constant noise from the sirens from all the police, sheriff vehicles, and all the helicopters in the air. And that's as far as sounds, those are the sounds that I don't think I'll ever forget. And, you know, anytime I hear the sirens or the helicopter sounds, it kind of takes me back to that day, as certain sounds tend to take us all back to that day.
Mm-hmm. So we read that you own a gun yourself.
Yes.
If you had had it with you that day, would that have changed the situation for you?
No, it would not have changed the situation for me. I do own a gun, and I would not want the gun on campus. I have not had the training nor the experience to fall into the role of someone that's a sheriff, a police officer, SWAT. I don't want that responsibility. We had a sheriff's officer who had been at the school. I'm not sure how many years he'd been here, but he'd been a Broward County deputy for 33 years, and he could not and did not maneuver or position himself or use his gun properly, and he'd been trained to do that. If the officer with 33 years of training was not able to use his gun properly, how are we or others that with a minimum of 144 hours of training, are we supposed to be able to use it? How are we supposed to be able to identify who a shooter would be? What if it was someone else trying to come in our room?
Well, what do you say to the superintendent in the Florida Panhandle, Bill Husfeld, who we spoke with yesterday, who said he would like to see teachers armed and that in the event of a shooting, it takes too long for law enforcement to arrive and leaves the shooter with too much time? What do you say to people who disagree with you?
To the comment, does it take time for them to get there? Yes, it does. Here is where I would come back with that, because it does. So you've got some issues there. And he's from a more rural county versus an urban, which we're from a significantly different metropolitan area that looks at things quite differently than the Panhandle does. That if our sheriff's deputy that was on campus that did have a gun was able to have responded properly because he was outside the hallway that would have entered the building to go in. If he had gone in and challenged the shooter, things would have been quite different, but he did not do that. So I'm supposed to, for a $500 stipend and with 144 hours of training, supposed to be able to do it with no way to communicate to whoever else I need to be communicating with for other law enforcement. I'm supposed to be the one to take on this and be the nurse and be the doctor and be the psychiatrist and the psychologist and the mother and the father and everything else to the children, and they don't want to pay us to be teachers. So I would say that the responsibility falls upon our elected leaders to provide the funding, to provide the people that are trained to use the guns on our campuses, if that's the solution that we need. What they've done is they found the very inexpensive way to sell a lot of guns, which obviously the gun industry and the NRA loves. For $500 and the training, they can get lots of guns out on campuses. And do you want people to carry guns that shouldn't own one? For example, here, a teacher here who has a conceal and carry permit actually went to Pompano Beach, went to the pier, took out their concealed and carry, their pistol that they had, that they are legally allowed to carry. They left it in the bathroom where they were using the facility, and a drunk found the gun and shot it. Okay, and so do I want that type of teacher to have a gun? No. What we do need to be able to have is a situation where we are trained to try to get into a safe location. And even more so, the one thing we've not done, we've not gone back to the root of the problem. And the root of this entire problem is it's too easy in this country for people to get rapid fire weapons for no reasonable purpose, and they're allowed to get them because the shooter that got the gun that shouldn't have had the gun was able to legally get it. We need to have these type weapons banned.
Do you feel any safer today in your school than you did when the shooting happened?
You want me to tell you the truth? Truthfully, I do not. There has been a lot of additional security, a lot of additional steps, additional fencing, whatever. But if somebody really wants to get a gun into a school, that's not difficult to do. And many schools have limited, if any, fencing. But our school, I do feel safer, but do I feel safe? Do I feel that I could never be shot? No, I do not. That's just completely false.
And how are the students and teachers there doing just mentally, emotionally?
Mentally,
a year later?
A lot of people are having a lot of trouble. I know this year we're going to lose a lot of teachers. A lot of teachers are not coming back. Last year we only had a couple that went to other schools. Everybody came back. This year I know a lot of teachers have put in for transfers. I know a number of students have left. The students have a lot of problems anytime, so do the teachers. Anytime we hear a loud noise, a loud sound, another classroom, two doors down the hall from me, a couple weeks ago had a palmetto bug, which is similar to a cockroach, except they're large and they fly. And, you know, it was flying in a room and the kids were screaming because they're afraid of this bug, which is really silly. But the classroom next door actually had to have one of the therapists come in and help them because they were so upset from the screaming that they heard from the adjacent classroom. Anytime a book is dropped, anytime there's a loud noise, everybody is very unsettled by any little sound, wow, noise, whatever. Most, if not all, the teachers are seeking help. Many of the students are, and we have a full-time set of counselors that are here all the time just for this, a whole section of campus almost it's put up just for that. We have like 3,300 kids here, so it's a fairly large campus compared to some.
Are you going to stay at the school?
Yes, I'm definitely staying at the school. When I do leave here, I will be retired, but I'm not doing that yet.
And why not? Do you feel it just a responsibility to stay there right now?
Yeah, well, one, I'm not quite ready. I'm not ready to retire. And certainly as long as I'm going to be a teacher, I'm going to stay at this school. I wouldn't leave here. I would never leave here and go to another school unless there was some reason that I had to, you know, for personal reasons. But if I'm going to teach, I'll be here at Douglas. I wouldn't leave Douglas until I retire.
That's Gregory Pittman, who is a history teacher at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. He helped many students on the day of the shooting last year and now opposes Florida's new law, which allows teachers to be armed. Gregory Pittman, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you very much.
The 2019 climbing season on Mount Everest will be one of its deadliest, that's for sure. At least 11 people have already died trying to reach the summit. By now, you've probably seen the viral videos of dozens of climbers in a thin line like a zipper along the spine of the mountain, waiting in gridlock. Many running out of oxygen, others forced to climb over dead bodies. The Nepalese government issued 381 climbing permits this year, a record. And officials defend that. They say it was weather that's caused the deaths, not the crowds. Earlier this week, Here Now's Peter O'Dowd got through to National Geographic reporter Freddie Wilkinson on Everest covering this season. Here's their conversation.
Even from thousands and thousands of miles away, those pictures of the crowds on that mountain are terrifying because you just know what a dangerous situation those climbers are in. But you've had a front row view of it this season. What's going on?
Well, the Everest summit season is just wrapping up, and in the next couple of days, the Sherpa team that maintains the Khumbu Icefall will begin to dismantle the climbing route to the summit. And so most of the action is winding down here. It was an eventful year, and there was a little more unsettled weather, which resulted in less days to summit and forced a lot of people to go for the top on the same few days.
Were the hundreds of people trying to reach the summit in those last few days, were they all well prepared enough to make the climb?
Well, you know, Peter, it's a very heterogeneous group of climbers on Everest. And so some were well prepared and some not so much.
Were you in that line of climbers trying to reach the top? I mean, could you describe what that would be like?
Sure. I should say that I was not up on the upper mountain. My job on this expedition was to work at base camp as a journalist for National Geographic, and so I was not cleared to go above Camp 2, but I had the opportunity to interview a number of climbers and guides who were up there, and mountains can get more dangerous the more crowded they are, and I think that's what we see happening this year. I also spoke to several veteran guides who were a little agitated about this narrative that has come from the photo of the line, and they were quite adamant that the line isn't killing people per se. It's more of a cascade of events, bad decision making, and a lack of leadership that is really behind some of the tragedies you've been hearing about.
What do you mean, lack of leadership? In what way?
Well, when you're going for the top of a mountain, you have to always remember that things aren't going to go according to plan, and be flexible, be willing to adjust your plans when something bad happens. On Everest, people do tend to get tunnel vision and keep going to the top, when maybe if there was a more experienced climber who could step in and say, geez, you're not moving too fast, and you've already used half your oxygen. You really need to turn around. Those sorts of sort of common sense decision making that sounds very straightforward at sea level, but when you're at 27 or 28,000 feet, it's hard to keep your eye on the big picture.
Plus, the drive to reach the top is so strong.
Yes, for every Everest climber, summit day is the culmination of a journey that is, probably years in the making, and certainly requires weeks and weeks of time away from home. So everyone wants to, get their best crack at the top.
Well, we'd also heard that some people were concerned that tour companies are not experienced enough, and they're letting just sort of anybody who wants to take a crack at the mountain, and that the government, the Nepalese government, is allowing too many permits. Do you think there's bigger picture problems going on here?
Yes. People need to understand that the guiding on Mount Everest happens in a very unregulated free market dynamic. And so there's a huge variety and diversity in the levels of professionalism that, different commercial expeditions provide. You do see that many of the Nepal-based trekking companies are charging less and attracting more of a budget client. Fees for a Western guided Mount Everest ascent cost around $70,000 and up, whereas you can book with a Nepali trekking agent for about half that, maybe $30,000 or $35,000.
That was National Geographic journalist Freddie Wilkinson in Kathmandu speaking with Here Now's Peter O'Dowd about the number of deaths on Mount Everest. Later this week, Peter will speak with the grandson of the last surviving member of Sir Edmund Hillary's historic 1953 climb of Everest, the first successful summit. So much has changed since then. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.